Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. On this week's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the importance of advocating for oneself and what can be accomplished by advocating for oneself. You don't always need to get a lawyer involved.
We'll speak with Kelly Pierce, who's had some successful experiences advocating with the Chicago Transit System, movie theaters, voting systems, ATMs, etc., usually without engaging legal support. But first for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Kelly Pierce, but you may recall last week's show in which Jim Fruchterman had some words to say about the importance of advocacy also.
My main tip is keep crusading for accessibility because that's really what we need to make progress.
Then just to respond to Jim Fruchterman's comments about advocating for yourself, part of it is speaking up. Often people don't ask for things. And as he suggested, a lot happens just by asking for it.
Yeah, one of the aphorisms we live by and have tried to instill in our children is ask not, get not. If you don't ask for something, no one's going to think to offer it to you. But if you need it and you ask for it, it really ups your chances of getting it.
Totally.
And as they both indicated, it really is important sometimes to advocate for your own self-interest because who knows what you need better than you do? At work, when it came to acquiring adaptive equipment, I couldn't expect my managers or people around me to know what kind of equipment I needed or what kind of tools I needed to do my job effectively. It was really my job to do some research, figure out what kind of equipment, what kind of tools were around, and to learn how to acquire those and see whether they would work for me. Sometimes you just need to take the ball in your own court and run with it.
And you were lucky because Xerox was very supportive and very generous in providing whatever tools you needed. But as your vision failed, they had no idea what the next tool was that you were going to need. So it was really on your shoulders to put in the request. And then fortunately, they were always accommodating.
And I was fortunate in that regard, as you say. But as we'll see in the rest of this show, if some organization isn't quite as receptive, you can still make a lot of progress.
Let's start by meeting Kelly Pierce.
My name is Kelly Pierce, and I'm a disability rights advocate.
Is that your profession, or is just something you do in your life?
Both. My day job is that I'm an advocate for victims of crime at a prosecutor's office here in Chicago. And actually, advocacy is part of my life and my lifestyle. It's enabled me to become amazingly independent compared to most other blind people.
So I take it you do have a visual impairment. Can you describe a little bit about your vision and how that came to be?
It's a genetic eye disease called Leber's optic neuropathy. I developed it in 1985, and I'm unable to read any kind of print.
So you use Braille and screen readers and assortment of assistive devices, I take it?
Absolutely.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is what Kelly refers to as informal advocacy. There are many reasons why one might want to engage in advocacy without engaging legal help, and that can include the fact that some barriers are too small for a lawyer or for a legal advocacy organization to take it on. And in many cases, the only option to obtain greater independence is to advocate on one's own, or, you know, the other choice is to do nothing and put up with whatever the problem is. We've done prior shows speaking with lawyers who do professional advocacy for people with various disabilities, including visual impairments. But you do your advocacy for people with visual impairments mostly on your own time. How did you get into this?
I got started actually when I was in college. At the time, the college was using Apple IIe computers, and the world was quickly shifting to PC-based computers, IBM-compatible kind of computers, as they were known then. And the computers that were not adapted with screen readers were the PC machines. And so eventually I advocated in terms of getting screen readers and speech synthesizers installed on some of those computers so I could access them and use them. And at the time, I learned something very significant and profound that has driven my advocacy over the next several decades. What I came to know is that the solutions for the barriers that blind people face are well known or easily identified and discoverable, and that they don't cost that much.
You started out advocating primarily for yourself then, but I take it this has branched out. Can you summarize some of the work you've done in advocating for people with visual impairments?
Sure. I've worked on substantially improving the transit system here locally in Chicago, from everything from our audible stop calling system to Braille in our buses and rail cars so people can identify them, to report any problems that they have so the system would improve access over time, to our voting system and helping to create and improve the audio interface for that. So it went from one of the least effective voting systems to one of the most effective, landing me an invitation to speak to Congress on the success and the means of how it could be achieved. In other words, how the voting systems can be so flexible that they can be modified to drastically improve access to banking machine access and ATMs. And my latest project is working on taxi fare technology and working with a company on that.
So before we get into some of the specifics of the work you've done and how you get started on these movements, as you know, on this show, we've interviewed several disability rights attorneys in the past, but primarily what you've been doing is individual rights advocacy. Can you talk about the differences and why it's important to advocate for the individual on that basis?
Well, not only simply with the individual, but groups of people, but without a lawyer, for example. I organized like about 20, 25 people to file complaints with our attorney general here regarding movie theater access at a major theater chain. That ended up resulting in certainly getting their attention and bringing some focus to the issue, bringing in our protection advocacy agency, and together that raised the issue sufficiently so resources were devoted to eventually reach a settlement agreement with that company to become, at that time, the largest installation of accessible movie theater technology in the world.
When you say accessible movie theater technology, are you talking about described audio or something else?
It would be described audio as well as the equipment to provide captions to deaf people.
And you got a major movie theater chain in Chicago to agree to do that for every movie in all of their theaters?
It would be a chain in the entire state, in every auditorium, in every theater.
For every movie you got described audio and closed captioning?
Well, the major studios don't release every movie with audio or closed captioning, but they probably release about 75% of them. So at the time, many theaters at this chain simply had one auditorium that was accessible in a large chain or a large theater of, let's say, 20 screens or something.
So that's pretty impressive. And I guess part of the message that you want to convey here is that we don't always have to ramp this up to getting lawyers and attorneys and all that involved, that you can accomplish a lot by just collectively grouping some individuals together and advocating for yourselves.
Yes. Sometimes in this instance, it was certainly bringing the attorney for the state in, the attorney general, but it wasn't like trying to find one and retain one and then have it represented and so forth. It was actually bringing people together, organizing folks, getting others interested, engaging a number of people, helping a community realize that this can be an important issue and achievable, and that the resources exist to significantly and dramatically increase accessibility.
So I'm sure there's a lot of people listening to this show who say, gee, you know, there's something I'd like to change in my community, whether it's accessible movies or curb cuts that point them out into the middle of the intersection, but they don't know more than two or three other people who are affected by the same problem. How would you advise them to go about embarking on a campaign like what you did with the Illinois movie theaters?
Well, the first thing is to become informed. I think that's the biggest advice I have for everyone wanting to enter into this advocacy space and do more advocacy for themselves. With the internet and all that it offers, Google search and Bookshare, it's easier than ever to become informed and become informed in an accessible kind of way. It's effortless and painless to become rather knowledgeable on topics and learn about civil rights laws such as the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And there's a fair number of articles written and guides and even answer lines and sometimes training opportunities that people can participate in and take advantage of. The first step to any of this really is becoming informed and recognize what is your legal right or what is a civil right as compared to what, frankly, is a customer service.
It's always good to know the rules before you get started, I guess.
Absolutely. One thing I see so many people doing is that they approach things and they have a desire for change. They realize that there is a barrier, but they're not often able or seemingly have invested the time in themselves to become knowledgeable and informed.
So now you've identified the problem and you know what your rights are and the rules are about accessibility. What is the next step in the process?
The next step really is identifying a solution. Too often people get into this and haven't also spent the time to identify what would be actual functional solutions that could be put in place. Not theoretical ones, but often solutions that have been successful somewhere else, and solutions that have been successful somewhere else or that are being used someplace else can then easily be put in place where you are. Obviously, it's a little more difficult trying to suggest something from scratch that no one has ever done before.
You know, I think that's very common in many areas of life. People tend to complain very easily and say, boy, this ought to be fixed. But then coming up with the ideas can sometimes be the hard part in identifying solutions.
And in so many instances, whether it's just a simple interaction with your boss or something where you're taking on a major institution, everybody reacts more positively if the person requesting a change proposes a solution, not just a problem.
Absolutely. And the important thing in thinking about solutions is that there often are more than one. Too often people get focused on what the solution is that they like or feel is important without taking a step back and realize that there may be several possibilities that could be equally effective or similarly of benefit to various people.
So now at some point, you have to approach the people from whom you're asking improved accessibility to do something, and you either do this individually or as a group. How do you generally go about that?
Well, it starts with, as you say, whether individually or as a group, you have to decide, you know, how sometimes it's good if it impacts you to start individually and informally, because sometimes things can be done just by asking for it, particularly if it's a small organization, if it's not that big of a problem, if it's something that's easily resolvable. Depending on what it is, it could be done just by asking. Often, though, if it's a larger organization, it often is useful to write it in form of a letter, depending on what it is. But there may be an accessibility group in that organization or someone who handles accessibility, or if it's very small, to address this with the owner. I find two issues. One is that people are often working too extensively with people on a low level who ultimately can't make a decision or have little influence on making a decision in an organization. Or two, they do a lot in communication by telephone or by email, and the emails typically are received by low-level people who aren't able to really make a real decision. So in the end, it may require writing on paper to an organizational head.
So I guess you're saying it's more effective to send a hard copy mail note rather than an electronic note.
Yes, and hard copies can easily be copied as compared to electronic communication, where after two or three or four forwards, it looks very messy and hard to read.
You know, I've often thought that sometimes it's not a matter of organizations or people being nasty, but it's just that they're not aware that there is an issue. And just as you say, letting them know and informing them that there is some accessibility problem, they're often eager to know that and very eager to fix the problems, especially if they're not too hard to fix.
Absolutely. I have heard many times, and I have now taken a lot of this on face value, that they say that this is the first time I've heard of it. You're the first one to tell me about this. I didn't realize it was this big of a problem. You are right. It is, in fact, many times the first time people have heard about the issue.
So you mentioned that often if you communicate by email or phone, you get the lower level people who really can't make decisions for the corporation or organization. How do you reach the people that are the decision makers? They're often difficult to find and squirreled away inside websites and hidden away behind people protecting them.
Well, that's certainly true for very large organizations, although in many instances, those large organizations, if they're government agencies, have people who are designated to handle disability-related issues. Otherwise, one can then let's write to the director of the program, the head of the organization, the CEO of the company, and then that can then be either read by them or directed to somebody who is able to handle it.
I guess in that case, a hard copy letter sent through the mail is particularly effective because you don't often see email addresses for directors of companies and the like. So a hard copy note will actually get routed to them.
Yes, their names are easily findable on the internet, for example, as well as their corporate addresses.
And if you're interacting by telephone, whether it's customer service or tech support, and goodness knows we've all done plenty of that, if you keep getting an answer you don't like, it's fair game to say, may I please speak with your supervisor?
That's often a good place to start, quite honestly. I mean, I always start with the basic customer service, customer assistance channels to see if we can easily resolve this.
So how did this work specifically with the movie chain in your state? When you approached them, what kind of reaction did you get, and how difficult was it to get in the door?
I personally didn't approach them because I knew other blind people had, for example, and they were receptive, but they were not acting on any comprehensive solution. So what I realized I needed to do was do it as part of a group, get a government involved in this. They won't ignore that. And then go to one of the local ACB affiliate and assist people in filing individual complaints with the Attorney General's office.
So if you wanted to find 20 or 30 other people with a similar complaint, how would you go about finding them?
I would start with people with like ACB or NFB affiliates, but really, quite honestly, most cases are not that dramatic. I mean, most instances, most barriers, really it is if you find one or two or three people, that's obviously significant for a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations, a lot of government services to take notice. And often the issue for blind people is things like websites or accessible formats or other kinds of barriers like that, communication issues of one kind or another that can easily be resolved.
And Kelly mentioned the ACB and NFB several times. These are organizations, the American Council for the Blind, and the National Federation of the Blind, the American Foundation for the Blind, that do a lot of work for the visually impaired and advocate in many areas. They're very effective. So you can look up those organizations, and we'll have links to those in our show notes. I wonder if you could comment on the tone of these letters and how you approach them. I've seen some letters that I look at them and say, gee, if I was the organization, I don't want to read this. You know, it's just too nasty or too aggressive.
I think what it starts off with really is identifying yourself as a person with a disability and describing your life. Realize that you're an individual who is blind or has a disability with a problem, and why this is a problem. People don't fully appreciate or understand disability and sometimes the barriers or limitations that it offers. And what you have done or accomplished or have asked people to do differently and to identify some of the attempts at resolution that have occurred and what you've sought in terms of a resolution.
I guess you kind of have to put yourself in the feet of the person receiving the message and what their likely background is and knowledge about accessibility issues.
Which typically is next to none. So absolutely, that's what is needed. In addition, people should also include policies or rules or regulations that would apply, because that's what separates a civil rights issue from a customer service concern.
So you've obviously been very successful in doing what we might call informal advocacy. You don't have a law degree yourself. What kind of skills do you feel are required to be successful in doing this work?
For blind people, computer skills are essential. That can't be understated. People be able to use programs to write things, to use the internet, to do searches online, and learn how to use web browsers and screen readers and things along those lines. And then beyond those kinds of skills, communication skills would be useful as well, to be able to express oneself in writing or in public speaking. So those would be also useful skills.
Well, those are useful skills for doing pretty much anything.
So to summarize, what is the overall message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
If it's important for you and your independence is going to benefit substantially from this outcome, then it's important to really consider advocacy and helping people resolve the issue, resolve the barrier, and develop functional, meaningful solutions for the problem. Part of raising the issue and identifying the solution is not simply to say such and such is inaccessible, but to explain why it's not accessible, how it's a barrier for blind people, and how it could become usable and meaningful, and what the solution would actually look like.
Now for this week's final item. We've been talking about engaging in informal advocacy on your own behalf or on behalf of a group, but there are times when you may not want to do so. And so for this segment, we will be talking about those situations, as well as giving some ways in which you can contact Kelly and the official people who help to enforce the Americans with Disability Act. So we've been assuming in this entire discussion that advocacy is a good thing. And of course, you provided many, many examples of just situations that you personally have been involved in where good results have come out. Are there situations where it might not be a good idea to advocate?
Yes, there are. In fact, a fair number of them. One might be in advocating in something that's sensitive to you or your life or that of people close to you, such as your place of employment or the place of employment of very close friends or family members. Another place is if you rely upon a service, and that may be the only service in the community where you are, and they don't seem too friendly to approaches or informal concerns that might be raised. Raising it on another level may cause a separation or people not to be too friendly, and it might block use of that service or good or whatever it might be.
Basically, it sounds like you're suggesting that in deciding whether or not to advocate about a specific issue, that you balance how big the current problem is versus how big of a problem you might create by ruffling feathers.
Absolutely.
How would you know when you reach the point where you actually need to contact a lawyer that you've tried everything you can think of by yourself and you haven't achieved success? How do you know when to contact a lawyer and how do you find one?
Well, the first thing to do would be to, when advocating, again, identifying solutions that are concrete, that would show clear distinctions of whether they would be done or not or put in place or not. So that's the first thing, is identifying solutions that can easily be measured in terms of whether or not that they would be accomplished. And then to identify an internally set timeframes of when it would be reasonable for entities to respond and to put those kinds of solutions in place. If those timeframes don't happen and you're communicating, and that a communication includes that if they don't hear from you or you don't hear from them soon, or let's say within 30 days, you'll take this to another level or you may seek legal counsel, then by all means, then do that.
So if people wanted to contact you to learn more about what you've done, to get some advice and to just talk with you, how can they contact you?
They can email me. My email address is kkellyp, that's two Ks, K-K-E-L-L-Y-P as in Pierce, at gmail.com.
And from a subsequent mail note after the interview, Kelly provided a phone number. Depending on where you live, this will get directed to the closest of 10 regional centers where somebody official can answer any question you have about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that phone number is 800-949-4232.
But don't worry if you didn't catch any of that. As usual, you can find all the information and resources we talked about in the show notes associated with this show. So go there.
That's it for show number 1519. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about creating accessible graphs and charts. Richard Ladner is a professor of computer science whose research is directed at enhancing the accessibility of documents and websites. We'll talk with him about his work to make textbook graphics accessible to the blind. The project is aimed at automating the creation of tactile graphics with the embedded text converted to Braille or speech. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey, and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and on audioboom.com at Eyes on Success, or Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success and have a nice day.